Good afternoon and welcome to Michael Creamer and Cushman & Wakefield's podcast, where I have the pleasure of introducing the wider world to a number of people who work in corporate real estate and talk about their backgrounds, how they got into property, what they're doing now, where we think the industry is going. It's my great pleasure today to have Alison Rankin, who at the moment is Global Head of Workplace Services at Schroders, but a relatively new job to her. And there's some interesting things we can talk about that later, Alison. But maybe we could start by talking a little bit about where you went to university. Did you study real estate? Kind of what got you into property? And welcome to the studio.
Thank you. No, thank you very much for inviting me. So I left school at 18 and went to Glasgow University, where I read economic and social history. That wasn't actually what I went to the university to study. So I went to do politics and management studies. But over time, whilst there, I surprised even myself by saying I actually really enjoyed economic and social history. So how does that get you into surveying? I'm sure you're probably asking.
That was going to be my next question.
So in Scotland, you do a four-year degree, and then I did a postgraduate conversion, so a one-year conversion of the three-year honours degree in Aberdeen. So I did the postgrad master's in land economy in Aberdeen. And I had a great time. You know, I really enjoyed it. To be brutally honest, I don't think there was a plan. I knew I liked history. I knew I liked politics when I left school. And there wasn't any defined career advice when I was at school. You became a doctor, you became a lawyer, or as they said to me, I should become a nurse. And I was fully underwhelmed by that prospect. So I scored well in my history exams. I thought, well, I'll go to university and I'll do that. Whilst there, I then met people that had studied land economy or actually were already surveyors. I didn't have any surveyors in my family background, so it was a mystery to me what property was. But along the way, I thought, oh, that sounds fun. I think I could be one of those people. So I spent my year in Aberdeen, and then whilst there, I then joined a training program, and I was successful and joined Weddell Green & Smith, who have probably had a couple of name changes since then. I believe they're BNP Paribas.
I think that's right.
And I did my two-year traineeship based in London.
So, okay, that was going to be my next kind of a question. So you're studying in Aberdeen and now figured out you need to get a job somewhere. Why London? And presumably that was to get your RICS qualifications, but you could have done that anywhere, I guess.
I guess I could have done it anywhere, but actually I really did want to come to London. My parents met in London, and there was always that draw to be in London. That's, to me, was where things were happening. And having lived in two big cities in Scotland, or relatively big cities in Scotland, I felt that, the draw of London was too great. And I got a job. That always makes it quite interesting too. So I came down to London, didn't know anybody, and joined the trainee scheme. And again, I really enjoyed myself. I did three placements in Wetherall's, in valuations, which was always compulsory, in property management, and also in insolvency. And it was a steep learning curve for me because I had done the postgraduate course rather than the undergrad. But I certainly learnt an awful lot through that process.
And I guess at the end of that rotation, which is obviously very similar to what graduates now do at the major firms, had you decided at that point which direction you wanted to head within property, or was that still open in your mind?
Relatively open. At the time, there wasn't an opportunity for me to do agency. At the firm I was training at. So at that point, I then left and went to Hillier Parker, and I joined as a surveyor doing office agency. Having done the other elements, it was the one part I didn't have, and I thought it was important to... I always felt that I wanted to sort of spread my experience rather than just specialising in one particular area. And having not done agency before, having qualified, I thought it was really important.
I think one area is always interesting to talk about is how people get jobs. And I say that because some of the people I've been talking to, like you at undergraduate level, had no background in real estate and kind of moved to London on a wing and a prayer and found a job or knocked on doors or networked with people. But so at this point in your career, you've found a job in London, so you've moved cities, and then you've moved jobs to get a different type of experience. Was that... to reading adverts in the back of the Estates Gazette? Was that through talking to people? How did that kind of come about?
I mean, that's exactly it. Looking at an advert at the back of the Estates Gazette, and I think I probably joined a couple of recruitment agents at that point too. Word of mouth as well. But yes, I mean, I think at that point the market was very strong, so it was probably quite easy to get an agency job at that stage.
Okay, and then what happened next? A couple of years at Hillier Parker doing agency, and then you moved, or?
So at that point, Hillier Parker, they had a corporate real estate team of probably about 9 people. And if you think that then evolved into CBRE, which I can't remember the figures now, probably has probably about 20 to 30,000 people doing corporate real estate now. That it's a huge evolution. It was right at the infancy of corporate real estate and global mandates or even regional mandates. So having supported on the agency side, I felt that was an exciting direction to go in. And I wanted to have more of an in-depth knowledge of one client or a couple of clients rather than just doing individual transactions. So at that point, I had an opportunity to move to Richard Ellis. And then I was given clients rather than just looking at individual transactions.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Always fun with these conversations. Most of the names of the companies that you and me included don't exist in the same form anymore.
I know we're a bit like dinosaurs, aren't we? But I think it's a good evolution as to how the profession actually has evolved.
Yeah. So we got you worked for Hillier Parker, which got bought by CB, and then went to Richard Ellis. Same thing. So
and then they got bought by CB. Yes.
And they got bought by CB. So you really haven't moved very much. You just
yes.
Well, companies have been gobbling up. Mm. And I know at some point you then switched to the client side.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that, because I think it's quite interesting to talk about what the differences are and in your case, what brought about that shift in focus, if you like, from the service provider side to the corporate side.
Yeah, so it then became CBRE, and one of my clients was a bank who've also had a name change, so now known as Santander, and I was supporting them on their account management, so disposing of buildings, acquiring buildings, and also supporting their branch network acquisitions. Mm. And they very nicely asked me to join their in-house team. So, I guess it's one of those things, there are always crossroads in your life and you think, well, that might be a good idea or that isn't. But I going back to that point of not wanting to specialise and feeling that actually it's really good and healthy to have a stretch of expertise or a wide breadth of expertise, it felt the right thing again to go in-house into an internal corporate team and see how it's done from the other side. So having been on the consultancy side to go in-house, it was another interesting experience. The demands and the thought process you have from a corporate side internal job rather than the consultants, the drivers aren't not necessarily about doing the best deal sometimes. You're making decisions based on what the business demands are. So it could be the absolute best transaction in the world. You've had the best rent-free period ever, but actually from the business point of view, it's irrelevant. So having to look at more than just one avenue when you're making a decision, that's really what it taught me.
Yeah, and I think, and of course, having studied what you did at university and for those people who've just done real estate, I think going inside a large corporate, just having worked in the service provider must be quite daunting because you don't understand business in the way that whichever company you are, you don't necessarily understand the business that they're in because you haven't worked in it. You don't necessarily understand how what, as you just said, is important to businesses. You have a great understanding of property and real estate and you think that's the start and the finish of everything. And then you get exposed to this completely different world of what's important.
Yeah, and I think whether you're client side or you're in consultancy, you do actually need to understand your stakeholders. So my internal stakeholders I treat them like clients. I've got to understand their businesses. I've got to understand what their drivers are. So it's the same process you go through. It's just you have to mold yourself. You don't mold them. It's you that has to flex. So I think I enjoy the personal interaction, building up a relationship, developing, and sometimes, you know, you can have good days and bad days, but I think that's part of the relationship building. And, you know, going through the projects. Certainly, you know, I've done a lot of travel through my work as well. So, you know, whether that's in the UK or beyond, there's always something new coming through.
And how do you, is that a skill that you kind of had to teach yourself or you had to develop? I mean, there's one thing you're talking about is networking, but you go and sit down in front of a business unit leader or head of a country and start talking about property. But how do you figure out what his business is actually doing or where you might be able to help in more than just the, you know, you need some more real estate kind of way? I mean, is that, because there wouldn't be training programs internally. So it must be quite, is that not a daunting prospect for someone who's switched from one side to the other?
I guess there wasn't a handbook. Yeah. when I
that's just a succinct way of what I just waffled and said. You're right.
Yeah, you know, no one gives you that handbook, but I, you know, through your manager, they'll give you pointers. You know, I guess I like reading people, and I like the challenge of trying to win somebody over and to understand what makes them tick. Mm. It's not to say I always get it right, but and I also do have, and maybe that's because of my interest in history and economics. I do actually really, I am interested how businesses work and how they evolve, because, you know, you can't stand still at any point. But I think it's more important now than ever that you are interested in different things, that you read, you know, variety of sources, because this actually makes you, not only does it make you interested, keeps your brain moving, but actually it means that you can be bringing different views to a meeting, whether that's for a client or anything else in between. So I think you have to be relevant, but equally you always need to be sort of, you need an appetite to find out what that next thing is.
I think that's absolutely right, and we talk quite a lot about curiosity being a really important skill, I guess. I mean, you know, an interest in the business. And you can certainly get a lot of stuff nowadays online and through other sources where you can find out what other people think of the company and maybe what divisions are doing, and then try and relate that and then think through how that might relate to the property and how you might be able to help. So the other thing you've kind of mentioned there also, which is another kind of life skill, but not something that's easy to learn from a handbook, but that sort of networking ability to read people, talking to people. Is that something you consciously think about before you go into meetings and think, okay, I've heard this person is difficult, this person's easy to get on with, this whatever happens to be, and kind of tailor what you do around that? Or is it sit down and figure it out as you go? Which may sound like a strange question, but you're walking in to see people you may only see once to do one deal with, and it's the first time you're meeting them. So it must be hard to figure out what's going to work for that person.
I think you can't just go in and sort of blag your way. Yeah, you can't wig it. I think you have to give a persona over that looks like it's easy. And that can be difficult for some people. And you know, there are meetings I go into where, you know, I might be nervous, but I can't, you know, I'm trying not to show it. You
right.
know, I'll put my good shoes on that day, you know, and that's what it is. It's whatever
it works for you.
But I think it is about doing a little bit of research. It's about doing your prep before you go into a meeting, finding out other people's views before you go in, because there's nothing worse than going in there having a very strong view and it being completely blown out.
Right.
And I think over time you do get better at it. It's not something that everybody finds easy, and we all make mistakes, but over time it gets better, you know.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying, which is absolutely right, it's all about preparation. It's thinking about what you need to do before you go in and having a different sort of, not different answers to the same question, but, you know, trying to figure out everything that you might get asked. So when you get asked it,
you
might not get a second bite at this. You're not going to, you can't really say, I'll come back to you in 20 minutes once I've read a book or ask three other people. You kind of need to do it there and then. Otherwise they dismiss you as wasting their time.
Exactly. Or if you generally don't know, not make it up and just say, look, you know, this is not my area, but, you know, I know the person to ask, you know. And that's, I think actually in business that's fine too. It's when you really try and go down a route of, you know, digging yourself into a big hole, then you'll get into trouble.
Good. Okay, so there you're at the bank, obviously learning in a way for the first time the real mechanics of business and what goes on, and then how real estate has or can have an impact. what happens next? Did you move on again? So did something great come along, or was your time up, as it were? What kind of spurred you into thinking about the next role?
Yeah, I mean, I think my time was up. They'd gone through a large acquisition, and there was a lot of redundancy going through the team and restructuring, and I didn't feel that the organisation was going as quickly as I wanted to go. I was probably slightly frustrated by a perceived lack of promotion. And at that point, I was also working outside of London for the first time, and I wanted to be in central London again. So there were, some good personal reasons for wanting to change jobs, as well as feeling that I'd done it. You know, I'd done that particular type of internal role. In-house role. So I then moved to a mini merchant bank and provided their, I was then their property specialist for their mergers and acquisitions, from doing due diligence on properties and on providing the property expertise when they were looking at businesses as well. You might ask, why on earth would you do that? But again, I was really interested in the process. Mm. And it's sort of a hybrid between being in-house and also being a consultant. So there were lots of elements that I could bring around, acquisition processes and due diligence processes from my previous roles. It was a small mini merchant bank. They were acquiring businesses. They were very inquisitive. I was a director of an AIM listed property business. I was learning things if I'd stayed in a CBRE or with an in-house role, I wouldn't have had that level of responsibility at that stage in my mm-hmm. career. So it just gave me, a confidence that you can do something else.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because I've stayed in the same business, albeit it's been bought three or four times, and I've done it in three different parts of the world. So I always say it's been very varied for me, because I've worked in different countries, albeit for a company that's been bought, so effectively the same one. But I think you're right. It's always about finding that next opportunity that teaches you something new. I mean, in my case, it was about working internationally, and that's what I was learning. The real estate part was you have to learn again, but the fundamentals are the same. The prices are different, and some of the drivers are a little different. But it sounds to me like you had this, moving every few years for the right reason is a really good way of building your career. You don't need to stay in the same place. And I don't think people view people who move a lot, let's say, as a negative, but rather there's a story to each particular role.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worked for me. If you want to specialise in investment valuations, then your route might be completely different. Right. But so in what I'm doing now, every single little element, whether that's facilities management, agency, looking at the profit and loss accounts, etc. Every single role I've had, I've been able to take a little bit of knowledge from each of those roles, and now I make it relevant now.
Yeah, so, and you can put it all together.
Yeah, put it all together. Yeah.
We'll come on to your role in a minute, because I want to use that maybe as a segue into talking about what you and I think the future of our industry is. Was BP your next job? Coming down to my own heart, because I, as you know, did a lot of work for BP 10 or 15 years ago. So how did you, or how and why did you move from effectively a banking career, if you like, in property, into something completely different, the oil and gas industry?
Okay. So I think you've got to remember the timing. So this was 2009, 2010. So we had the banking crisis.
that would explain it.
I didn't have a job, actually. I was made redundant. It was amicable, but at that point I was made redundant. And I had a baby, so I took some time out. And then, having taken a little bit of time out, then decided to go back into full-time employment. And the reality was there were no jobs in banking mm-hmm. at all in 2009. But the oil and gas industry was doing very well. And there was an opportunity that I was given at BP.
And maybe before we talk about that, because you touched on something interesting, but I mean, being made redundant, albeit for, if you like, good reason. You hadn't done anything wrong, as it were.
Yeah.
But that still must be, I don't know, is that a blow to your ego? Is that something that was hard at the time? I mean, now you can look back on it and you've got this great career, so, and you moved on. But at the time, was it something that was difficult to to cope with or understand? Or was it just you went, the banking crisis, this happens, I'll find another job?
I think now I can look back and there were lots of good things that did happen in 2009 and 2010 that make it feel, much better. But I guess I wasn't the only one. There are lots of people, not only just in the property industry, but across the industry that was made redundant during that period. It wasn't personal. The reality was they weren't raising money in my organisation at the time. And, they weren't going to have people just sitting there twiddling their thumbs, So therefore, I didn't have a role. So yes, I was made redundant. I don't think it has a stigma. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, there was a large stigma about being made redundant. It happens a lot now. And I guess it's all about, your own attitude to these things. A lot of people left the industry at that point. But I didn't. I survived. I did get another role.
Good. And then going into BP, I guess one of the questions I had is, as I said, obviously a very different organisation. I imagine majority of what you did up to this point was offices, mainly CBDs or large cities. And now you've got a completely, a completely diverse portfolio in some interesting parts of the world, which a lot of people haven't been to. So how did you, was that a challenge? Was that part of the reason you left? And how did you deal with kind of learning another part of the real estate industry? And is the business of BP and the people you had to interact with very different to the business and the people in the banking sector?
So BP is a global organisation. When I joined, it had 110,000 employees. So I'd gone from an organisation which probably had about 20 to 30 people in all in one room to 110,000 people across the globe. That in itself was a bit of a culture shock. Mm. But BP as an organisation, they were very kind to me. I do think it's a good organisation. They were going through their change at that point because the Gulf of Mexico had happened. So, although the oil price was strong, they were under stress, they were restructuring, they were having to cut costs. So you were going into an environment that was moving very quickly. From my point of view, it was the diversity of the role. I've always travelled, certainly for the last 15 years, I've done a role where I've been able to travel. My region was EMEA, so Europe, Middle East and Africa. I had property projects going from Shetland in the north of Scotland through to Moscow and Angola. So I would always jokingly say that was the golden triangle, But, it was fascinating because each one had its own cultural differences, weather, extreme weather, actually, in all three. Mm-hmm. I was dealing with industrial offices. In Shetland, we operated an airport. So I was negotiating, an airport lease. Going back to the handbook, there isn't a handbook, but you have to go back to basics of, what am I trying to achieve? What are the priorities? What am I trying to negotiate? And then building the relationships along the way as well. So, I had projects where it was, retired sites, so sites that were no longer needed, selling them off, looking at contaminated land. Yeah, I really enjoy the diversity, and I think that's what keeps me interested. Is when it's lots of different things happening that you have to link together.
And do you think that the the people that you interacted with at BP, so the business people who you had to go and talk to about property, was that very different to the banking experience? And did you have to adopt a different way of getting across the same messages, or was it by this point, because you obviously got a lot of experience by this point, you just go in as the property expert and it's the same type of approach?
Again, it goes back to being flexible. BP predominantly is full of engineers and very process-led. So, again, I had to flex. I had to manage my meetings that in more and have more structure to my meetings. And that's not to say I'm not organized, but actually there's a when you're dealing with a mechanical engineer, they have a process for everything. Yeah. So even the meetings have to be done in a certain way for them to feel comfortable that you know what you're talking about. They don't, you know, they are not subject matter experts on property, but they know how to do a project. So I learned a lot about how to set projects up for success, how to bring people together, communication. And that's not, none of that's about property. That's just about good leadership and, making sure that everybody, bringing people together. You don't learn that at university. Unfortunately, that's the bit that comes post-university.
Yeah, and I think, and you mentioned the word culture earlier, and I think that's sort of what you're talking about now in a slightly different way, but it is about thinking who your audience is. And as you say, you have people who are engineers and have a process for everything, then show them a process for getting from A to Z on a property deal, and they'll start to assume that you exactly.
Yeah, gives them comfort. But then you've got to overlay that if you're looking at projects across different regions, you've got the cultural differences of a transaction going on in Moscow versus a transaction in central London or in other parts of the world. You can't just go in there and assume they're going to work in the same way. The way you shake somebody's hand, the way you address them, the way you even dress matters, but in very different ways. So, I think I've learned good and bad from, turning up in Shetland in a suit when most people turned up in a T-shirt and a pair of jeans.
Yeah.
I only did that once. Yeah. To making sure that you're dressed properly because you're going to Dubai, because, culturally, right. you've got to there's a certain way to dress, or, holding somebody's business card, etc. So, that's doing your preparation, doing your prep before you turn up to a meeting.
And how do you go about doing that? I guess, so you're at BP, you're using an outsourced provider. Let's say you're going to Moscow, for sake of argument, for the first time. You could easily think culturally not very different. You figure out what the weather is so you can dress appropriately. But how do you figure out the cultural nuances of doing business so that you don't get it wrong? I mean, you talk to the person on the ground you're going to meet and ask them, or...
Yeah, I mean, you've got to get an ally pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Or ask somebody that's been there before, the do's and don'ts. It's true. And some of it you won't learn until you actually get there.
Until you get it wrong.
Yeah. Until you get it wrong. And then they'll tell you.
we've all done that. Because it's interesting, because that, I think, being sensitive to it and thinking about it beforehand, some people don't, and I'm sure you have. I've certainly been in meetings where you almost want to take someone outside and say, it's just not going to work if you continue along those lines, because you're now beginning to insult the people we're trying to do business with without even meaning to.
Yeah, and it can be such a simple thing that you just get horribly wrong. I mean, I've got to be very conscious of my accent. I mean, I've got a Scottish accent, and I know I need to, slow down sometimes or just be a little bit less...
Don't be the Brit abroad who, when they don't get what they want, just raises their voice. Right?
Yes, exactly. But also, there's nuances in my language that, particularly on the phone, not everybody will get. So, again, that's just me having to think about how I approach things.
Yeah, and I think, from what you're saying, I'm sure you're the same. But I have to say, loved going to different countries and figuring stuff like that out. And as you say, it doesn't matter if you get it wrong, as long as you realize you've got it wrong and you change. But it is part of the fun of our business that you get to travel and do the same business but in a different way.
Yeah.
And have to figure out what that is. Cool. So there you are at BP. So talk to me about the last move, and then I want to touch a bit on, get into the specifics a little bit around the actual role, because we haven't talked about, because by this point you're the super experienced person.
Yeah, I guess. Imposter syndrome. Or
you're exactly.
That point, yeah. I've got very happy memories of BP. I had a great boss who so you know her well. I was very supported, but I think, like everything in life, there comes a point where you you want, certainly for me, I wanted a little bit more, and there wasn't the opportunity for me to step up within BP at that time. And my boss was very supportive and allowed me to go out and learn different things. I became a trustee of a charity, which I still continue with today, to allow me to get a breadth of experience beyond working in the role that I had. But equally, that didn't satisfy me enough, and I wanted to run my own department, my own function. So, but I wanted it to be the right role in the right organisation, because I did have a very good environment at BP. So I wasn't rushing for that job. Yeah. So it had to be right. So, but I'm incredibly lucky. I joined Schroders just under a year ago, and I'm thoroughly enjoying myself.
So maybe you could explain a little bit. So you've turned up at Schroders, and you're being quite modest, but you're head of workplace services, as I said at the beginning. Can you explain, maybe two parts, but explain what workplace services encompasses, and then I wanted to talk a little bit about what all of those, if you like, what I'd call service lines actually do.
Workplace services can also be known as corporate services or real estate. It covers a myriad of functions. For me, I've got responsibility for global travel, security, and real estate, and that includes facilities management. At Schroders, that the model is, or certainly has been, that this would be delivered locally, but we're going to a new model where, over time, I'll be taking over a global responsibility for the delivery of services that basically help the organisation to work. So my role is basically to make sure the lights are switched on, that they've got a great environment to work in, and that there's ease. So from the moment they come through reception through to you going to their desk, that the place is clean and tidy, efficient, and that the clients and also the employees have a great experience.
So, that's interesting. It is one of the ways our industry, I think, has definitely shifted. And although people have been talking about it for a while, there seems now to be this huge, and I think it's absolutely right, emphasis on both the employee experience, but also the customer experience who's coming to your sites. Does that start for you with the facility, what we would refer to as facilities management? And maybe you can just explain what facilities management sort of now means, because I think it does mean different things to different people.
Yeah. So in my world, facilities management is the cleaning, security, making sure that we have a front of house reception, so the meeting and greeting of staff or guests coming into the property, catering as well, events management, and if we have a charity function, we would be running a charity function. There isn't any one day. I think it's like running a hotel. Right. So it's operations without beds. I mean, there's so many things that are asked of us that we need to provide to the our clients.
And would I be right in saying then that's becoming increasingly important to the organization because it's customer facing, number one, and number two, because it's about employees? Because we talk a lot in our industry now about this employee experience and millennials and people entering the workforce who want something different to perhaps when I entered the workforce, and there's so much talk around that, and it seems to me we're finally beginning to link what you might refer to as the HR piece with the technology piece and the real estate. But are you seeing that? Do you work very closely with the HR function about what it is that the employees really need when they come to the office?
I mean, I think it goes across many functions. So my organisation, Schroders, we want to be the employer of choice, but we also want to, we are client-facing, so we want to give the best service to our clients as well, an appropriate service to our clients. So to be the employer of choice, we've got to look not just at, are the lights on and is the place clean? It's about well-being, it's about sustainability. And certainly within Schroders, we as an organisation are asking the companies that we invest in to run sustainable and businesses and also to do the right thing. So actually, as an organisation, we need to be doing that first.
You better be doing it.
Yeah,
as well.
we need to be doing it first. So when it comes to, we call it ESG, but the sustainability and governance, it all interlinks. So the way we look at our food offer links with our recycling and our food waste. We have no single-use plastics in our global headquarters. We're going to be rolling that out across the rest of our buildings. So, it's all interlinked. Mm. And our employees think it's incredibly important. And as an investor, we think it's important. It's, on both levels, it's the right thing to do.
And you haven't talked about facilities management up to this point. So when you joined Schroders, if I'm right, that's a new area of responsibility that you've taken on.
Yes.
So that, again, sort of story of your career, right? Just take another job with some bits that you haven't done and figure it out. Which I think says an awful lot about you.
Much more planned than that, I'll tell you. I've got a really good team.
Yeah.
I've got a very knowledgeable head of FM who is subject matter expert. There is no expectation that I will know everything.
Yeah, but I think the reason I say it like that is not to say you can't do it, but simply because it means it's about managing. You're now at a point in your career when you've moved from being the subject matter expert when you started and were learning it to being actually now, I feel like, a subject matter expert in managing people.
Yes.
Be that people who work for you, but also the business that you have to interact with, and start to figure out what will help the business.
Yes.
Be more successful. So now, to me, there's a shift when you get to this sort of senior level that you've got to start thinking about how you impact the business in a way that's more than just the cost of the real estate, which is obviously huge, but how are you helping the business be good at what it does?
Yeah, and so it goes back to being inquisitive. So, and being curious, and sometimes a little bit controversial. I think my role is to have an inquiring mind, and to be looking for the next new thing, whatever that next new thing is, or actually just finding out what other people are doing. There is always somebody else doing it better, and that's okay. I think it's okay to find out how they're doing it, because then maybe we could learn from them.
Right.
Thankfully, over the years, I have built up a good network, and I am able to ask questions of people. And my role is bringing people together and solving problems. And hopefully along the way, developing a strategy and a plan so that we've got a goal to go, a point to go to. I'm very keen that we look and perform better in our sustainability initiatives. I want to create offices that are of good quality, but also somewhere that people actually generally want to go to. So, but we've got to link that in with the HR. But it's not, I don't work in isolation. I've got to work with our branding team and our marketing team and HR, because it doesn't matter what I do. If those other guys aren't with me, then, it won't work.
Yeah, and I think, I think that's absolutely right. And there's this for me, the, if we look forward over the next 5 years, there's a really interesting inflection point in anyone joining the industry now, from university all the way through to people who've been working in it for a long time. We've got to figure out what those new skills are. As you say, you've got to be curious, but how do you go find the next best thing? And it's easy what you might go and see, you've then got to figure out how that relates to the company that you work for.
Yeah,
and we have too much talk in our industry about, what Google or Facebook are doing. That's great for them.
Yes, it's
going to
be.
That doesn't mean it's going to work at Schroders. So how do you take that and think it through in a way that then says, oh, here's a really good idea, which if we twisted it 90 degrees and applied it to Schroders, it would get us where we want to get to.
Exactly. I mean, we're not an organisation that's suddenly going to have slides and ping pong tables.
Exactly.
That's not the culture.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But actually what really is important to them is the food offer and the well-being initiatives and, the ability to have, bikes in storage. And, there's other elements to what's important to them, which in some other organisations would be standard or actually not even not even considered.
And do you have a system, I'm going to say, yeah, but a systematic way in which you figure that out? I mean, are you just going around talking to people? Is it anecdotal? Do you run surveys? How do you know what's important and what's less important? Because then you have to start making decisions around capital spend and raising that money, you know, or getting permission internally to spend money here and not there. How do you kind of pinpoint what you need to do and what the cost is and what the return is?
Yeah, so we have an annual employee survey, which, you know, a lot of focus is put on that survey around. It's not just about the working environment, but the benefits as well, you know, to the organisation. I overlay that with best practice and what other organisations are doing. We are competing for employees like everybody else at this moment in time. So I need to ensure that what we're doing is on par, if not better. But also my role is to provide consistency across the network and make sure that we're doing the right thing, making the right decisions. I take the vision from, I report to the CFO, so I take my direction from him. But then I have to then model that into a real estate strategy as well. So, and there's influences, and, you know, I do get emails from people saying, can we do this? And, you know, this is really important to me. We cannot make everybody happy, but, you know, it's about ensuring that we're doing the right thing.
Actually, you touched on something else there, which I wanted to maybe finish up by covering. You report to the CFO, and I'm sure during your career you've reported through to different job functions. But given it's the CFO, when you're going to him and saying, you know, the staff survey says we've got to improve the food offering, that would make everyone happier, and we can do that, but it's going to cost us more. How do you justify, or how is there a business case that you have to write that helps them understand the importance of it? Or because most CFOs want to see a number output. They want to see productivity have gone up, hard to measure, if they're going to spend £5 more per person on lunch or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So how do you figure that part out?
I mean, there's always a business case for everything. So you put the numbers down, but then you have a discussion. It's not always about the numbers. We make decisions on things that cost us money, but actually we believe it's really important, either from a perception point of view or a wellness point of view, because it's the right thing to do. Sustainability programs will cost us more money in the longer run, but actually we've made commitments, for example, to RE100. So by 2024, we will have 100% renewable energy across our global network, whether that's the buildings we invest in or actually our occupational portfolio. That could be more expensive. But actually, what we're saying is this is the right thing to do. This is how we're going to achieve sustainability for this generation and beyond. That's a business, that is a purely financial decision, but we are willing to take that. So there, it's not always easy as saying, oh, it's going to cost us £2 more. And that goes back to the business context we were talking about earlier. Mm. It's not always about the money. It's about doing the right thing.
And then maybe that's a good place to wrap up. But I just to make that point, maybe again, it's you've got to start with the numbers, I think we're saying, but then you've got to have the business context in which you are operating. Successful business like Schroders wanting to do the right thing, asking its investors to do the right thing.
Yes.
You have to kind of live and breathe what you're asking other people to do. So the business case becomes more apparent, you know, as opposed to a business that maybe is not doing so well and is just taking cost out left, right and center, much harder to make those arguments. So almost not worth worth trying. So sometimes this is about timing.
Yes.
And some of it's about the type of business that you're in, and then latching onto those trends or whatever you want to call our business opportunities
what
and making
are.
Real estate. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no point going to any organization if they are losing money and saying you want to spend X amount on a brand new building. That will not. It's not the right thing to do. The markets would probably not react particularly well to you making that large investment at that period of time. You've got it. I always go back to, you have to be flexible. You need to understand your client and you need to understand what the business drivers are at any one time, because you have to adapt your recommendations, whether you're in-house or you're a consultant, because you've read your client.
OK, Good. Well, Alison, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I think we're going to call it to a halt there. Good luck with the new job.
Thank you.
We're going to have you back in the studio when you're up and running globally and see how that journey's been.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.